live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how an extract of pomegranate seeds attenuates the glucocorticoid-induced bone loss. In lay language, how you can help your bones mineralize and stay strong with pomegranate. And why morning workouts provide more benefit than any other time of the day. And how the omega-3 fatty acids show promise as a stroke treatment. That's from Columbia University. And also a little more in-depth today, a novel magnesium compound reverses neurodegeneration, some research from Martin Alessio, and more on health and healing. Then we're going to look at many social issues, including, is a leading suicide prevention organization really a front for big pharma? Martha Rosenberg does the research on that. And from our environmental segment today, we have an interesting overview about where do we stand right now? What is the likely outcome if we don't make major change? Dar Jamail from Truthout gives us these insights. And then from Lawrence Davidson from Consortium, America and the Plague of Moral Idiocy. Also my guest today, I decided to have a topic that many of you actually asked about, and that is restoring the paranormal and the unexplained phenomena in our lives as a legitimate subject of study, and then the limitations and spiritual dangers of our postmodern materialist worldview. My guest is Professor Jeffrey Kripal. He is the Newton Razor Professor of Religious Studies and Permanent Department of Religion at Rice University in Houston, Texas. And his areas especially include comparative religion, paranormal, mystic experience, the history of Western eroticism, counterculture, religious movements, pop religion, and the psychological study of religion. So he is a formidable person in this field. We look forward to this discussion. I'm setting more time aside for that. If time permits, what happens when scientists treat cancer with cannabis? And also, how big banks are buying all of our politicians. So we have a full lineup. Let's begin. Now, pomegranate is one of the most nutritious things you can put in your body. It literally deserves the title superfood. Just a few of the things it does. It can help rebuild the inner lining of your arteries and your veins, the epithelium. It helps with your digestive tract. It helps with blood pressure. It keeps the blood thinner. It helps reduce stress. It's good for your heart and it's great for your brain. Now we can add one more onto that. According to the Department of Orthopedics, we can add a pomegranate seed to, quote, attenuating glucocorticoid-induced bone loss and hypercalcemia in this study. In just lay language, it means that when you take pomegranate on a daily basis, you're better able to have stronger bones. So we knew that calcium, magnesium, boron, phosphorus were all important. Now add pomegranate to that. Most people work out in the morning because we're more anabolic. From about 4 a.m., when our body begins to come out of its deeper sleep, where we come to think or dream easier or aware that we're awake and just want to stay comfortable in bed, that's when we're more anabolic. Then we get up in the morning. And if we do it right, we'll have some lemon juice and some water. Remember, proper oral hygiene, because if you don't remove some of the acidic element in the mouth from the lemon juice, you could end up eroding some of your gums. Because some people will suck on a lemon, or some people just have pure lemon juice and wash it around their mouth. Shouldn't do that. But lemon in water, drink it down, that's terrific for alkalizing the body. Then you want to take some beet juice or dark green vegetable juice and take your supplements, ideally coenzyme Q10 and magnesium, potassium, and cayenne pepper, vitamin C with bioflavonoids. Those are terrific for your heart. That means you're going to have a healthier workout. And because of the nitric acid in the vegetables, your muscles will be better supplied with oxygen and nutrients because your blood is flowing better. So here's the deal when it comes to working out. The benefits of exercise are known to everyone. This is not a secret. But we look at the morning workouts, and that is compared to the late afternoon, early evening, or late night workouts when people get home from work. The general rule is that when you work out early in the morning, you're stimulating your metabolism. You have more energy. It will enhance your mood throughout the day, and that's important. So the morning workout is the best workout. So that's just the latest on that. Also today, the omega-3 fatty acids, according to a study at Columbia University, published in PLOS ONE, is good for stroke treatment. A doctor, MD, PhD, Dr. Tin, and colleagues at Columbia University's Medical Center induced a stroke-like condition in these mice, and then they found out that if they gave DHA, they had a neurological reaction and evaluated them over a period of 9 weeks, and they found that it was reduction in brain injury. That is very important. If we could reduce cerebral infarct volume and improve reflex assessment compared to, you know, not having it, that means if you do have a stroke, and people are going to be having strokes, the quicker you can get the omega-3 fatty acids, DHA, 400 milligrams, 500 milligrams into their body, the less damage to that part of the brain. Now, I also have suggested many times they get them into hyperbaric oxygen treatment almost immediately. That could protect them. In fact, recently when a friend of mine had a stroke in his car while I was going home, he's a dean of a university, and when I heard about it, I said immediately asked the hospital to put him into hyperbaric oxygen therapy, and then I gave a protocol. Unfortunately, the hospital did not have hyperbaric, and they would not transfer him until he got out of his condition. Well, he didn't get out of the condition, went into a coma, and ultimately died. That's the type of thing you don't like to hear when it's a friend. And you know the interesting part? I'd actually gone over a stroke protocol with this person a year before when we were driving out in New Jersey. And I said, always have a heart attack and a stroke protocol available with you at all times. Just carry it. Small little package. You know, you put this, you know, you put four cayenne capsules, you put 3,000 milligrams of magnesium from citrate, and you put 2,000 milligrams of coenzyme Q10. I told him all the things put together. Never did it. So it's time that we paid attention. Protocols can make a difference, can save a life. Now, one of the things that can help everyone's brain is magnesium. But it's not just going to help your brain. It can actually help lessen the acceleration of Alzheimer's and dementia. And by the way, Alzheimer's is now at an epidemic level. It's the sixth leading cause of death in America. And I believe it will go right up to being number one or number two within the next 10 years because of all the people who are older who are going to be knocking on Alzheimer's and dementia's door. I see it in people I know. In fact, it's sad when I used to have, I won't mention his name, he's a very famous person, but every morning at 10 o'clock sharp, he would stop off in my office, 83rd and Broadway, come upstairs, walk in, and we'd have a chat. And he'd tell me the work he was doing and what was going on in his life. And it was always a very pleasant experience. And when I had my restaurant, Gary's Place, over in Columbus, I always set a table aside because he and a group of artists would all hang out together at night. These were very famous artists. And they came in every night, and they'd spend like 3 hours there. And it was interesting because every single night he would do artwork on napkins and give it to the staff. I'll bet they thought it was just garbage, threw it all away. Wow, if they would have kept it, they'd have something of value today. Anyhow, over the years, we would have dinner every week and talk about life issues. And then I started seeing the day, I will never forget it, where in 1 hour conversation, he brought up the same topic 10 times, but not remembering the other 9 times. And I finally said, are you aware you've gone over this? He says, no, I didn't. I said, yeah, you did. We discussed this. You talked about this. He said, really? And so he said, would you put me on a protocol? So I gave him a protocol. And for about 6 months, he followed the protocol and made major improvement. No more of that. Then he stopped the protocol, and I saw the decline. And today it's advancing tremendously. And unfortunately, he doesn't have a support system that is helping look for other alternative ways of dealing with it. So when it's someone close to you, it's a family member, it's a very close, lifelong friend, and you see them needing help, but then the question is, will they use the help that you're providing? More often than not, the answer is no. They just won't. And we must always respect that barrier. We can go up to it, but we cannot cross it. At the end of the day, people must be allowed freedom of choice, even when the choice is not going to give them the result that they like. But that doesn't mean you can't encourage them. That doesn't mean you can't be letting them know what is possible to change things. So I'm just simply saying we're going to have an epidemic, a pandemic of brain disorders in the next 10 years. Why? Well, and what can we do about it? Well, let's make it real simple. I won't go into a whole brain protocol today, but we're looking right now at dementia and Alzheimer's affecting upwards of 30 million people worldwide minimally. And you can look at that going to 200 to 300 million in the near future, because almost everything we're doing creates inflammation. And it's inflammation, the soft drink, the sugar, the hamburger, the hot dog, the pizza, the barbecue ribs, the french fries. This is what causes it. It's that simple, and more people are leaning towards that. So what's one thing we can do? Well, we can look at magnesium. Why? Because magnesium is instrumental in protecting your aging brain structure and function. And traditional magnesium doesn't do that, not in the brain. Regular magnesium is great for your musculature, to allow it to relax at night and overcome aches and pains, especially if someone's got maybe a construction worker. And just yesterday, I counseled a construction worker, and he does heavy lifting, big guy. So I said, do you ever take an Epsom salts bath? He said, nope. I said, well, take an Epsom salts bath with 1 gallon of Epsom salts, and also take a particular type of magnesium, and look at the difference in how you feel. Now, that's for the muscles. The same magnesium citrate, or gluconate, either one. This just one's a very small molecule, the other's a very large molecule. The other will help your heart, helps prevent heart attacks, and helps keep your heart rhythm normal. That's one of the ways I help people have arrhythmias or tachycardia or AFib, is magnesium, hawthorn, azuma, coenzyme Q10, and ginkgo. Ginkgo is great, by the way, for irregular heartbeat. In any case, there's one type of magnesium that's great for the brain, and that is magnesium L-threonate. T-H-R-E-O-N-A-T-E. And that concentrates more efficiently in the brain and rebuilds ruptured synapses and restores the degraded neurological connections that we observe in people with Alzheimer's, memory loss, ALS, Parkinson's. It's really good for memory loss. And in fact, in one experiment alone, magnesium threonate was able to improve by 18% short-term memory and 100% in long-term memory. And you have better functioning of memory-forming synaptic connections. See, here's how it works. Given the effect of magnesium threonate in increasing synaptic density and plasticity, you find that you simply have a better capacity to learn and to remember what you have learned. So it's increase the number of functioning neurotransmitters, release sites. And that is linked to increasing number of soldiers on the battlefield. It also improves spatial short-term memory, and which is essential memory function, helping you remember where things are and where you are in relation to the world over the short term. It is working memory that enables you to find your car keys or to head out the door or return to the correct page in a magazine you were reading or book in just a few minutes. So that's what it does. But when you're low in magnesium, you accelerate your brain aging and memory loss. And regular magnesium just does not do it. That's why you need that special type. And it can make better recall and increase brain cell signaling. It does all that. So de-age your brain and don't join that large group of people who are accelerating brain aging. By just taking one nutrient alone can make a difference. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. You know the rules, and so do I. I've still commitments that I'm thinking of. You wouldn't get this from any other guy. I just want to tell you how I'm feeling. Gotta make you understand. Never gonna give you up. Never gonna let you down. Well, last night I decided to go to a concert and went down and saw the person you just heard, Rick Ashley. I hadn't seen him in 30 years, since the mid-1980s, and he did a performance downtown at, I think it was a town hall or town center, one of those, on 43rd Street. It was terrific. If you ever have a chance to see him in concert, he's extraordinarily warm and upbeat and funny and personable and self-effacing. He's 50 now, and he talks about the difference when he made his hits. His hits were when he was 19, 20, 21, and he premiered a new album. Now, normally when you go to see an artist, you go because they're old hits. And so they try to offer in some new songs. Well, his new songs were phenomenal, so I'm glad to see he's going to have a really good new album out. I always like to go see the ones from the past, Hall & Oates and all the rest. And I saw some of our listeners there last night. It was nice to see people out just enjoying an evening in the great city where so much vitalism exists. In about 15 minutes now, we're going to go to our guest, Professor Jeffrey Kripal, to talk about all those unusual experiences you've had where you didn't even know if you wanted to tell anyone because they thought you would be crazy or delusional. But there's something behind those. You're not crazy. The paranormal does exist. So we'll be having a discussion with one of the leading religious professors in America. Want to share a couple more things before we do. And I want you to listen to a short clip. This is a scientist, as a part of a team that was researching the cannabinoids, or cannabis, marijuana extract, on cancers with phenomenal results. Listen in, please.
When we treated these cells with cannabinoids, THC, the main psychoactive component of cannabis, it was killing the cells in our petri dishes. We were killing the cells. So we thought that we were facing some potential antitumoral responses. And then we decided to analyze these compounds in animal models of breast and brain tumors. The results we have obtained are telling us that cannabinoids may be useful for the treatment of breast cancer. We started to do experiments in animal models of glioblastoma, brain tumors, and we observed that cannabinoids were very potent in reducing tumor growth. cells can die in different ways. And after cannabinoid treatment, they were dying in the clean way. They were committing suicide, which is something you really want when you have an anti-tumoral drug. One of the advantages of cannabinoids or cannabinoid-based medicines would be that they target specifically tumor cells. They do not have any toxic effect on normal, non-tumoral cells. And this is an advantage with respect of standard chemotherapy that target basically everything. I cannot understand why in the States cannabis is under Schedule 1. Because it is pretty obvious, not only from our work, but from work from many other researchers, that the plant has a very wide therapeutic potential.
Well, the reason why we're not looking at the thousands upon thousands of scientific studies done on cannabinoids is because of the alcohol industry, because of the pharmaceutical industry. Imagine being able to help with a glioblastoma or astrocytoma or a lung cancer using something that is non-toxic but very effective, like cannabinoid oil, and compare that to chemotherapy. If the money and control and power is behind the oncologists and chemotherapy, then they don't want anything to compete. So we talk about laissez-faire. We talk about democracy. We talk about the power of the marketplace, and yet we don't want competition. That's why everything that's really wrong in America, in part, is because it's so big. The huge corrupt bureaucracies of the military-industrial complex, the pharmaceutical-industrial complex, the big energy complexes, the banking complex. And so they don't want something, and that's why they'll keep it scheduled. And if we really had a leader anywhere in our government, a real leader, first, most important thing they would do is decriminalize all drugs and get treatment centers for those who need to withdraw from the drugs, but do so in a way that is both humane and holistic, and then open up the prisons of all non-violent offenders, and then change the, get rid of the war on drugs, and suddenly think of all the crime, the murders around the world, 120,000 murders in Mexico in the last 10 years alone, Honduras, the murder capital of the world per population, drugs, Colombia, drugs. Think of what you would do to change the impact of drugs on average citizens' lives. You take the profit out and watch how you change it. If you took the profit out of medicine, watch how many people would benefit. And also, if you took the profit out, then we could have universal health care, which any reasonable country would offer. Everything now is about how much we can tag on to that medical bill. Did you all see the article and the photograph where a father who had already paid something like $14,000, more or less, for his wife to have a simple, uncomplicated pregnancy, just wanted to hold the baby? Fine. They charged him $40 on his bill for holding the baby. It's called skin-to-skin, you know, contact, and that was a billable charge. That's how bad it's gotten, and it won't get any better unless we do something. Also, for anyone who is suicidal, be careful about the suicide hotlines that you call, because what we're finding is that some of these are really nothing more than fronts for big pharma. And then once you get on their line and you get into their system, then it's all about being diagnosed and treated with pharmaceuticals. Well, what if the cause of your suicide is the pharmaceuticals? Because one of the side effects of antipsychotic and antidepressive drugs is psychoses and depression and suicide. You wonder why 23 American soldiers every day are killing themselves with their own hand? Almost 100% of them are on antipsychotic medications. It's not helping anyone. It is a failed system. But here's the irony, and here's the corruption of a big government. When you have bureaucracies like the Veterans Department and the Defense Department working in cooperation with private interests, such as the pharmaceutical industry, then their idea is just make one protocol. Everyone who has a problem, give them a diagnosis and a drug. But they never care about looking, does it help someone? Does it hurt them? Are they better? Are they worse? They don't care. But then again, medicine doesn't care. They're rewarded whether you live or die. So we have to change the paradigm. Disconnect from what we have. Right now, we have humanistic, holistic suicide prevention hotlines that have no affiliation with any pharmaceutical company. Because I'm looking at an investigation by Martha Rosenberg, which we've posted so you can read it in depth, and it shows you, for example, that, quote, suicide increased more than 150% in the Army and more than 50% in the Marines in an 8-year period, reports Military Times, and then it talks about prescription drug increases are at the same time. So as the drugs were increased, including Zoloft, 73,000 prescriptions and 38,000 for Prozac and 17,000 for Paxil and 12,000 for Cymbalta, up goes the suicides. So even if you're a government employee, it doesn't mean that you have to dismiss something that is so obvious. If you have low suicide rates and low use of psychiatric medication and you suddenly increase your medication, you have high suicide rates, then look at it. But that's where the top people in the military industrial complex come in and say, don't do it. We don't want this. And hence the results are not there because somewhere that person's getting a benefit from connecting with a pharmaceutical company. So the soldiers' lives are worth nothing to these people. What they get from the pharmaceutical company obviously is, and that's unfortunate. So maybe that's something people in this audience might want to think about, and that is putting together a more humanistic suicide hotline. And I'm sure there are some, but you better do your homework to see who finances it. And if you start seeing that they're recommending drugs or getting some psychiatric evaluation test, find another source. Now, I'm going to say I have a very in-depth, major investigative report coming up on our next program. We just got through being legally vetted, and our scholars and residents vetted it for accuracy. I'm going to give it on Monday, and it is going to blow the lid off. The people who are attacking the parents and activists and scientists who are opposing vaccines, who are opposing GMOs, who are opposing nuclear. There's a group of people behind all these, and we'll show you who they are. I'm going to name them, show the evidence, all on our next program. We're going to go to a question in about 7 minutes. Before we do, however, I want to mention that we wanted to give ample time. One of the problems we had the last retreat we gave, it was a fundraiser for our sister station, WBAI, and they told me, the manager called me with 9 days and said, can you do a retreat? And I said, I'm on the road filming. I only have a short period of time, a week, and it starts in 9 days. And that's when we did it. Now we want to let you know when our next retreat's happening. I'm only doing 2 weeks for the entire 15 months. So if you want to come to a health retreat, I'm giving you lots of advance time so you can make a plan. 1 week in January 8th through the 14th, and then the first week of April. They're in two different locations. The first one, we're still interviewing and looking at different locations where you're near the beach, and we're going to different resorts. And it takes a lot of time to find the right place to do one, but it's going to be great. And why would you want to come to a retreat in January? Well, how about that you could change your life? You could detoxify. You could de-stress. You could learn about life in ways from the lectures, personal counseling, unrushed, where you have a good amount of discussion where you can look into the issues in your life you want to change and improve. You can learn exercising, de-stressing, Tai Chi, cooking classes, gardening classes, homesteading classes, juicing classes, juice all day long, gourmet vegan meals served by a master chef, all and vegan and gluten-free. Do as little or as much as you want. No stress at all. Just be with nature. Be around wonderful people. And we all need it, but we don't all give ourselves that opportunity. We give ourselves excuses, rationalizations. Well, here are some people that attended in August, and here's what they had to say about their experiences.
and I have just finished a 2-week stay at Gary's retreat, and I can't really say what this has meant to me because I don't even know yet, but I know that it's totally turned my life around. It's been the most incredible experience of my life for a lot of reasons. I came down here as a stage 4 cancer patient ready to go into hospice. And I'm walking out of here, literally walking without a cane, without anything to help me, and feeling better than I felt in a year, 3 years. And I'm so grateful, so incredibly grateful that I've had this time to reevaluate a lot of things in my life. I literally was unable to walk without some type of aid when I came here. And within 3 days, I'd put the cane down and I was walking and sort of power walking, nothing like what they do down here, but I was doing it in the best way that I could. So I cannot say enough, and I don't even expect people to believe what I'm saying because it seems so phenomenal that I would have a breast tumor that would go down almost 2/3 while I'm here because of the attention, because of the energy, because of everything here. I go home a different person, literally go home a different person. So I can only say thank you to everyone here, to all the people that have played a role in this. I sort of came here against my better judgment, not believing that anything could really make that much of a difference. And knowing that if I had 2 months left to live, that at least maybe Gary Null could help me make the best of those 2 months. And I go back fully charged and ready to go to work and continue where I left off 3 years ago. I was a registered nurse for 40 years. And one of the things that I did was I was a certified chemo nurse, chemotherapy nurse, and worked a lot in heart, lung, liver, kidney transplant. But my belief in chemotherapy was that all my patients that had had chemotherapy were dead, and I was not going to take it, so I went the natural route. I had 3 breast tumors initially 3 years ago that metastasized into bone cancer, liver cancer, and spinal cancer. And at this point, I don't feel that there is any pain there like I was having. I was having excruciating bone pain for which I was taking narcotics for, and now that is gone. And so I am just blessed to have been given this opportunity and every person here that has made this happen. I only wish I could make it happen for other people so they can benefit from this also.
Hello, my name is Francis, and I spent a week here with Gary's retreat. It's really enlightened me so much. Gary did some energy work on my arm. I have cancer in my arm, and I used to have so much pain, and I have no pain now. And I sit and I'm, and it's the swelling that I had in my arm has decreased. And I've also learned disciplines too, especially I was not into exercise before, and now I'm determined to exercise every day and stay on the diet that he's given to me. And I'm very grateful for Gary. Thank you.
Now, those are just a couple of the people who I can't promise and don't want anyone thinking, oh, well, go to Gary's and be cured. I don't advertise that, promote that at all. But I've seen some wonderful things happen to people who decided to give themselves an opportunity to do some deep healing work on themselves, to reflect, to become mindful, to relax, to meditate, to cleanse and rejuvenate. And we have a wonderful staff that helps people in this process. So in the next 15 months, I have exactly 2 weeks, one in January, one in April. You can choose either one. And I have Luann Panessi on, who helps with every single one, and she helps do the counseling. She does some lectures. She also makes sure that people who are coming understand what they're going to get and that they're actually what they expect and need, what we can supply. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary.
Well, I'm very excited to be part of this next retreat. And I've already had a lot of people calling in, very excited about coming down. So if people are interested, one of the things I want everyone to know is that we only take very nice people. and I interview everybody. So if you're a very nice person and you're ready to get in touch with your essential self and be the best that you possibly can be health-wise, then give me a call. I'm going to have you call my cell phone. That number is 973-766-2214. That's 973-766-2214. And I'll look forward to speaking with you.
Okay. Again, it's these things always fill up, and I want people to be able to take advantage of them. I want you to be able to be as healthy and happy as you want. We've seen so many people with depression and anxiety gone. So we have Luann's connection's poor. Please disconnect it. I'm getting a ringing there. But anyhow, if you want to really have a week to change your life in the most beautiful environment with some of the nicest people and most talented people, give Luann a call. Her number again is 973-766-2214. We're going to be back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. I just can't deny. Welcome you. Now we're going down to Houston, Texas, where Professor Jeffrey Kripal, that's K-R-I-P-A-L, who is the Newton Razor Professor of Religious Studies and Chairman of the Department of Religion at Rice University, is standing by. And he has done so much to empower people into understanding that because it's not been scientifically proven doesn't mean it's not real. His newest book is The Supernatural, A New Vision of the Unexplained, co-written with the nonfiction writer, Whitley Strieber. Nice to have you with us again.
Oh, thanks, Gary. Thanks for having me. It's been a while.
Yes, it has. And I thought it's time, and why is it time to do this program? Because I rarely do programs that investigate issues concerning the supernatural or paranormal phenomena. Yet if we look at some of the unusual statistics of the number of people who have had weird experiences, including the experiences of knowing someone was going to, you know, call on a phone, but there was no reason they should, and suddenly the phone calls. Or they have a dream, and the dream becomes true, or they have a vision. And even today, there was someone emailed me an article where the last of the Gibb brothers, who had three of his brothers die, the Bee Gees, the first thing in the first paragraph was that his brother is still with him because he saw him come into his house in a certain color jacket and he felt no fear and he knows that they're with him. Now, someone could say, well, that's delusional, but there are millions of Americans who claim they've had some sort of experience that could not be identified or qualified by our normal reductionist mindset. And I don't believe that we should be dismissing people who believe that prayer has power, that there are people who have unusual gifts in this world, the gift of energies, exchanges. I've seen it. My entire adult life, I've dealt with health issues and anti-aging issues and alternative approaches to disease. But what people may not know is that for 33 years at the Institute of Applied Biology, where I was doing all this original research, I also was doing the paranormal research. And I didn't discuss it because the other scientists downstairs would never have accepted it. These were chemotherapists and people looking for new drugs, miracles. But the director of the Institute said, I believe in this. I just can't allow anyone to know about it because it could affect our funding. And so he said, but keep doing things. And all those years, I saw enough going on that I could quantify to show that the paranormal is real. And yet we live in this world of measured objectivity, the woo-woo or illusory. And so much of life's mysteries are in one sweep of the rational mind swept aside and disregarded as nonsense. And I consider this to be a symptom of our living in an increasingly materialistic culture. So when you started to explore alternative ways to understand paranormal experiences, you collaborated with Whitley Strieber, who has earned a reputation for his morphological memoirs of unusual and bizarre experiences. So on the surface, it seems odd that a prominent American scholar, the chair of a religious department at a prestigious university, would co-author a book with someone who has been, well, looked upon as sensationalistic when it comes to the paranormal. So please begin by sharing with us what Whitley experienced or understood that compelled you to investigate some of these phenomena. The form is yours.
Sure, Gary. So a few years ago, I was working on a long-range project, which is essentially an intellectual history of the paranormal, showing how the paranormal and psychical phenomena really were all coined and originated in major universities, both in England and the U.S., places like Cambridge and Harvard and Duke. And so I was trying to show how these were really deeply intellectual, deeply professional people. And then I moved into, I wanted to see how the paranormal functioned among creative writers, particularly people who make graphic novels and science fiction movies. And during that research, I picked up Whitley Strieber's Communion, which is a book he wrote in 1980, published in 1987. And it's based on a series of experiences in his cabin in late 1985. And that's the book that really set in the public imagination what an alien or a gray might look like, primarily because of the painting on the cover. But when I read the book, I was really struck by how sophisticated Whitley was in talking about his experiences. He never actually says he had an alien abduction. He doesn't know what they were. He calls them the visitors. And from page one all the way to the end of the book, he suspects that actually it was some form of us that was interacting with him. It was something human or superhuman or future human. And I was just so struck by the pure intelligence and the nuance and the self-critical nature of this book that I wanted to get to know him and correspond with him. So we began corresponding in about 2010 or so. And about two years ago now, we decided to try to write a book together. And the basic idea of the book is that Whitley's descriptions of his own abduction and paranormal experiences are encoded with all kinds of sophisticated theories about what religion is, what folklore is, what belief is, what these anomalous experiences are. And it would be my job as a professional scholar of religion to sort of tease those out and kind of bring those out, make them more apparent. And so that's what we do in the book. He basically talks about his life and his experiences, and then I pull out the theoretical implications, and then he responds to those, and then he talks about some more, and I pull some more stuff out, and it's a back and forth conversation between a really quite remarkable experiencer and myself as a professional student, really, of religious experience. So it actually makes perfect sense. Okay. As I said in the book, look, if students and scholars of religion can't understand and help make some sense out of someone like Whitley Strieber, I have no idea what we're doing studying these things in the past when they're right in front of our noses. So,
well, let's carry forward with that idea, because as one of America's preeminent scholars in extreme religious and spiritual experience, what are some of the other types of extreme paranormal experiences that should be regarded as legitimate on their own grounds? And how do you account for the identifying them as part of our natural world and not simply strange anomalies or fabrications?
Right. So there's a whole range of these. So I would put what we now call near-death experiences in this basket. I would put apparitions of dead loved ones. I would put precognitive or telepathic cognitions, which you mentioned at the beginning of the story of the episode. I would put a whole rich collection of what we call CORT, cases of the reincarnation type, which are basically small children who have very distinct memories of previous lives. All of these things have been studied extensively. All of them have rich, rich archives. They're all just sitting there, really, waiting for people to come and study them and try to make some sense out of them. What was the second half of your question, Gary?
Well, you actually answered it. When I ask you about the extreme paranormal experiences that should be considered legitimate, but in your estimation, what are the reasons why it's important for scholars to study and research extreme paranormal experiences? And in your classes, do you provide any guidelines to students who are intent to pursue the paranormal? In other words, are you recommending ways to approach this subject without getting caught into taking these experiences too literally, because
yes,
they are still nevertheless subjective to the
yes,
people experiencing recounting them? And I just remember one classical one, and that was a young child being able to speak in a language he had never been taught about things that he could have no understanding of. And when they went back to research this, I believe it was in Romania, everything that he said was borne out. And how in the world could that have happened? How could a young kid know something that happened in Romania 100 years ago and speak the language when his parents didn't speak the language? And people can just slough all that off. But I've seen too many of these to discard them.
Well, yes, and that's good proof that these cognitions are not simply subjective. That's something that people often say, that they're just subjective. They're just in the head of so-and-so. But it's actually not true. In many cases, there's an empirical hook, or there's an empirical validation of the cognition. That's what makes them so remarkable. So someone thinks, you know, they're going to see their 5-year-old daughter laying on the train tracks the next day, and sure enough, through a series of bizarre events, they do. So it's not just in their head. It's a paranormal event is essentially something that appears within a person's mind or head, but then plays out in the physical, historical world. You need both, really, to have a paranormal event. The way to study them, what we do in the book, Gary, is we encourage people not to believe, but also not to debunk. We encourage people to approach these experiences on their own terms, as if they were texts or stories or signs that were trying to tell us something. And we encourage people to essentially just listen and not believe the imaginative framework in which they appear, you know, in other words, aliens from the sky or something, but also not to debunk them, that this person's delusional or he's lying or whatever strategy you want to invoke. Neither of those strategies really do justice to the depth and poignancy and power of these experiences. They clearly don't work. We're trying to propose a third way in this book. And it's called the supernatural, but what's not clear to your listeners yet is that's actually three words, the supernatural. We're not proposing a belief system here. We're not proposing a traditional supernatural. We're arguing that these are part of our natural world. They're extremely common, and they beg for engagement and interpretation and explanation.
Well, let me give you an example. This year, about 6 months ago, I watched a small film, and it was about an Indian living in India back in the beginning of the 1900s who had an unusual gift. He could compute numbers without adding them up. And in fact, he got his first job when he could do counting faster than the person who was using the apparatus in an office. And from there, he began to look at other numbers until one day, the top mathematician in the area offered him some challenges. By the way, this person had no formal education. And from there, it was recommended that he send a paper he had written to the what was considered in that area the greatest mathematical scholar in the world, who was at, I believe it was Oxford, either Cambridge or Oxford. In any case, This was at a time when you had Bertram Russell, minds like that, in the same institution. And this person thought it was a gimmick, a joke, but he was invited. And here this Indian young man is standing in front of this scholar, and no matter what question or problem he gave him, he was able to solve it instantly. And so yet the bias was so great that no one would accept it. But this scholar took him under his wing, and in time, he was allowed to challenge the chairman of the department and of each of the chairmen. And he would challenge each person, and he won. He did so in ways that no one could figure out. In other words, the normal way you come to an answer, he didn't use that. So how could he come with the correct answer if he didn't use the existing paradigm to get there? And finally, after years of prejudice and bias and beating him up and wanting to throw him out because he was Indian and the racism within the kind of upper elite class in England was palpable, he was finally allowed to be a fellow. And he was one of the youngest fellows in the Institute's history. And to this day, the work that he did, which opened new doors, is still acknowledged and honored. Now, for me, if you're able to come to a solution that all the best and brightest brains in the world, all trained in classical sciences, and you're not, and you come to an answer that they couldn't have, then that is something that we should recognize. Now, if that happened in math, why couldn't it happen in other areas? Your thoughts, please.
Well, you're probably referring to Srinivasa Ramanujan.
That's correct.
Right, right. The Man Who Knew Infinity is the name of the film. The short answer is, of course, it could happen in other areas of knowledge, and it does happen. Scientists and philosophers and artists come to their forms of knowledge by non-cognitive or non-rational means all the time. The history of creativity is just filled with those stories. One of the problems with it is that it challenges how we're taught to think about mind. We're taught to think about mind as just a kind of epiphenomenon or fuzz around, you know, the brain. It's just a product of brain. But actually, for most of our history, people thought of mind as transcendent in some ways. And certainly mathematics, certainly in the Platonic stream, you know, one doesn't figure out or create a mathematical formula. One discovers it, which essentially means for the Platonists that it already exists. All knowledge, particularly all mathematical knowledge, already exists in this sort of infinite mind. And so it makes actually really good sense that someone like Srinivasa Ramanujan could somehow tap into that through his own devotional practice. He attributed it to his family goddess, by the way. He was a devout Hindu. So it makes good sense that he could somehow tap into this and just get the formulas without being able to, you know, work his way toward them. But that, of course, goes against, almost everything we assume in our materialist worldview. And I think that's why we don't hear more about these stories, is they're so cognitively dissonant with what we're supposed to believe.
Jeffrey, when you look at the healing arts and you see this commitment, almost obsession, to reductionist principles of how to treat cancer or heart disease or depression or anxiety, they completely exclude anything that's a non-rational event into basic thinking.
Right.
And the argument that the reductionist or the materialist tries to protect a flatline worldview or mindset and does so by marginalizing or censoring or attacking or excluding everything that cannot fit into some of his or her flatline categories is so common, and yet these people are rewarded for their efforts but never for their results, because they don't get the results. And people who've gotten good results of healing disease and understanding the communication with nature and how important it is and understanding the power of the spirit, these people are then relegated to a kind of a religious mysticism of no inherent value. And the materialist worldview is perpetuated. So speak further about what you refer to as the historical amnesia in the materialist worldview, because this is something I witness among the most ardent fanatical proponents of reductionist medical science and in the atheist corners of neuroscience who want to relegate all experiences to biochemical activity in the brain.
Right. So there's a lot to say there, Gary, probably more than we have time for, but you know, a couple things. First, I think we have to give them their due that the materialist paradigm does work, to a certain extent. I mean, you and I are talking on a phone right now because of the materialist paradigm, and we're 1,500 miles away. And when I get a headache, I take some Tylenol, and the headache goes away because of the materialist paradigm. So that I think we have to acknowledge that it works to a great extent. Where it fails miserably is when it tries to explain consciousness or us as conscious subjects. And that's where I have real problems with it. And why it doesn't acknowledge paranormal experiences, a couple reasons. One is they're not replicable. You can't faithfully and consistently replicate them in a laboratory. You can't measure them. So you can't disprove them either. So they fail all of these parameters that you need to stay within the scientific method. And they then conclude from that they don't exist or they're not real. And, of course, that's where they make a philosophical mistake. Just because something doesn't behave by the rules of the scientific method doesn't mean it's not real. It just means it doesn't behave by the rules of the scientific method. It lies outside those parameters. So the way I put this is it's like going to the North Pole to prove the existence of zebras. You're just never going to be able to do that because you're in the wrong place and you're playing by the wrong rules. You need to go to Africa. You can't go to the North Pole. So when debunkers say, well, you can't replicate this in the laboratory, that's just more or less equivalent to saying, show me a zebra at the North Pole. You have to honor the conditions under which the phenomena appear and not prioritize your own particular method or your own particular assumptions.
Well said. I remember there was a study that I did for over a two-year period, and I invited some leading psychologists and a psychiatrist to observe. And there was a woman from the Dominican Republic who, I was told, had the power to calm that which was imbalanced in the person's mind. And she had her own set of rituals. What she said she saw when she was looking at people was the battle of energies. The dark energy, the light energies. And I can't tell you how many people would come in who were extremely psychotic and off the wall, and this woman would just sit there, talk with them, and frequently in a way that they didn't understand what she was saying, but they felt it, hold their hands, next thing this person would just completely change. And the psychologist had no way of understanding it because it didn't matter what kind of person she was dealing with, how extreme the psychiatric diagnosis, she was able to help it. A simple, humble woman who had this gift from birth. Science has no place to put that. There's no way to objectify that to see if it's real or not real. But for the people she worked with, for everyone in her hometown in the Dominican Republic, it worked. And so you're suggesting that she is the zebra at the North Pole.
Right.
And the people who would criticize this are simply looking at their own paradigm. And as you said, some paradigms work. But one of the great, I believe, a great person who had mystical visions was probably the greatest electrical genius and physical genius of all time. Do you know who I'm talking about? Who didn't get the credit for all that electrical work?
Yeah, I know who you're. Tesla?
Tesla. Yeah, he could not have come up with all that by pure reductionist, and he didn't. And yet his work today is virtually non-existent within most of the paradigms, so a lot of what we see today was used by him. And I'm sure that if we looked at the other side of many other great minds, we would see this unique and remarkable connection to maybe an alternative reality that some people simply don't even know exists. But you have opened our eyes to this, and I thank you. And I also thank your co-author for writing The Supernatural, A New Vision of the Unexplained.
Our pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Gary.
I look forward to another conversation.
Okay, good.
All the best.
All right, bye-bye.
And from Houston, Texas, the chairman of the Department of Religious Studies and also the Newton Professor of Religious Studies, Professor Jeffrey Kripal. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day. I need the people that I really love.